Good afternoon. I'm Professor Tom Gage from the English Department at Humboldt State University. And today, thanks to the curriculum organization, the California Association of Teachers of English, we have with us Dr. Leonard Schlain. Dr. Schlain is the chair of laparoscopic surgery at California Western Medical Center in San Francisco. He is a writer and has written 3 books, The Art and Physics, Parallel Visions in Space, Time, and Light was his first publication. The book that we're going to be talking about today is The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. And his forthcoming book is entitled Iron Sex, The Origin, Politics, Economics, and Human Mating. And that will be out this summer. Dr. Schlain, it's good to see you again.
Pleasure to be here.
And I've been so very interested in your work. As you know, I've created a course that I'm teaching this semester, which is a play on essentially the title of your book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. One of the wonders in my using this wonderful book is how a physician and writer came upon this thesis.
Well, as you pointed out, I wrote this earlier book entitled Art and Physics. And I remember when I was writing it at the time, and the thesis of the book is that the visionary artists all throughout history had anticipated the great ideas of revolutionary physics, and the artist used image and metaphor prior to the scientist using numbers and equations, but that if you match the two, you find that there's a correlation. So to write that book, I was very interested in the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, and I remember when I was writing it, people would say to me, so what are you doing these days? And I'd say, well, I'm writing a book. And they say, well, about surgery? And I said, no, actually, it's about art and physics. And you could see their eyes would kind of glaze over, and they would say, well, but you're not an art historian or a physicist. I mean, you're not an expert. Well, the book came out, and I'm pleased to say it did actually very well, and it's used in the course curricula of many universities and art schools around the world now. It's been translated in different languages. And then I got a call from Harvard, the academic press, and they were publishing an Encyclopedia of Creativity. And they asked me, they said, would you be willing to write a couple of the entries? And I said, I was very pleased. And I said, well, thank you very much, but why are you inviting me? And they said, well, you're an expert. So I said, oh, okay, I wasn't an expert, and I wrote a book, and I'm an expert. So I felt if I could be considered to be an expert about two subjects like art and physics, that I ought to be able to write a book about women and religion. So the genesis of the book is a question that had always bothered me, and that is, in the Eastern traditions, you can be a Buddhist, a Taoist, a Confucian, and a Shintoist all at the same time. It's not a problem. In the West, you can't be a Jew and a Catholic and a Muslim or a Protestant all at the same time. It's impossible. And that's such a striking difference. And when I realized in my reading of history that prior to the Western three great religions, there really wasn't any religious intolerance. I mean, people killed each other for a lot of different reasons in the ancient world, but killing each other over religion was not one of them. So in ancient Egypt or Mesopotamia or Greece or Rome, if you wanted to worship Apollo and I wanted to worship Zeus or somebody else, that was fine. I mean, it wasn't an issue. And then it became an issue. So about when I wrote Art and Physics, I was very interested in the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, the 60s media theorist. And before I subspecialized in laparoscopic surgery, I used to do a lot of vascular surgery. And a common operation was operating on the carotid arteries of the brain. So I've always been interested in the right and left hemispheric specialization that's unique to humans and to the degree that it is, and it's really quite extraordinary. So I've always been fascinated by this disjunction between the two hemispheres and their assignment to different functions. So about 11 years ago, I went on an archaeological tour of Mediterranean sites, and we had this incredible guide from the University of Athens, this woman professor, and she basically told us the same story wherever we went. You know, whatever we were standing before, whatever temple it was, Zeus, Apollo, Poseidon, she said, you know, this temple was originally consecrated to a goddess, and then unknown persons, for unknown reasons, reconsecrated it to a god at a later date. And the trip ended at Ephesus, and I was standing at this extraordinary panorama of this enormous city that was dedicated to the goddess Artemis, and they showed where the men came to venerate her and where the women came to venerate her. And I thought, you know, this is really odd. Something happened in history, and I don't know what it is, but on this long bus ride back, I was contemplating if there was a time when both men and women worshiped goddesses, and women were priestesses and performed major sacraments and led armies and owned property, then what could have been so immense and so pervasive in the culture of the West that would have caused the elimination of goddesses for the next 3,000 years? So I started to look into this, and there's a whole bunch of different theories as to why it happened. But I came up with one that was based on my knowledge of the brain function and McLuhan's theory. You know, Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message, and by that he meant that the process by which we put out information and we take in information is more important than the content of the information. So it was clear in his writings that in an oral culture where people only speak and listen to each other, that when you're listening to somebody, you're occupying your left hemisphere is following what the person's saying, and then your right hemisphere is looking at the person, and you're kind of evaluating whether they have alcohol in their breath or dandruff on their shoulders, and you know, you're checking out their body language. And so there's an enormous amount of information that you get when you're listening to somebody as to what the message is. And then, so in other words, to listen to somebody, there has to be a lot of cooperation between the hemispheres. And then when you speak, even though Broca's area in your left frontal lobe generates all this speech, you still need the cooperation of both sides of lips, tongues, and vocal cords. If you've been to the dentist and you've had Novocaine, you have trouble talking, you know. So to speak and listen, there has to be a lot of cooperation between the hemispheres. But when you write with only one hand. I mean, up until the invention of the typewriter keyboard, for 5,000 years, it didn't matter whether you were a man or a woman writing. It didn't matter what you were writing about, and it didn't matter what language you were writing in. The hand that controlled the writing implement is the same hand that hurls spears and swings swords and pulls triggers. So I became fascinated by the possibility that the introduction of writing, particularly alphabetic writing, transformed culture. That the reason the goddess disappeared, it was an inside job. That the thug who mugged the goddess was the invention of literacy, you know. Sophocles once warned that nothing vast enters the life of mortals without a curse. And I think everybody in the audience would agree with that. I mean, if you won the lottery ticket tomorrow and you won all these millions of dollars, you could count on something unpleasant happening as a result of winning all this money. I mean, I read that this guy who just won all this money in New Jersey didn't even come forward for several days until he hired a lawyer and guards and all kinds of things because he was afraid that along with this wonderful bonanza would come something quite negative. So I think that everyone would agree that the invention of literacy was vast. So the question is, what was the price that we paid as a culture to acquire this extraordinary means of communication? And I think that what happened is that alphabetic writing, because it proceeds in a very linear and a very sequential fashion and requires mainly the activity of the left hemisphere of the brain. And in the book, I show how the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of a right-handed person, whether they're a man or a woman, that everyone acknowledges that they have a feminine side and a masculine side. I mean, everybody does. In the book, I give them anatomical mailing addresses. I say that the masculine side of both men and women is primarily in their left hemisphere. And the modules necessary to look at a pre-verbal infant and tell that that child is, you know, from the inflection of their tone and their body language and the tenor of their cry, what the baby needs, are located primarily in the right hemisphere of both men and women who are right-handed. So what would be the effect on culture of reinforcing the masculine side of the brains of everybody who learns a skill? And I maintain that what that would do is produce an enormous amount of patriarchy and misogyny. And I show how, and by the way, the right hemisphere's functions are primarily gestalt perception, seeing everything all at once, the parts to the whole, and recognizing faces and images. And the left hemisphere is primarily devoted to language, sequential, linear, one word after another, one sentence after another, one paragraph after another. So the first book ever written in an alphabet is the Old Testament. I tell that to people and they say, oh, the Phoenicians wrote something. I said, name it. I mean, what book did the Phoenicians ever write that ever has any influence on our culture today? The oldest book that has a tremendous influence is the Old Testament, about 900 BC. And in this book are the Ten Commandments. And the first commandment is the most revolutionary sentence that was ever transcribed. First commandment states, I am the Lord thy God, there is no other. Now, the Old Testament doesn't actually state that this deity is a man, but all of the nouns and adjectives used to describe him are Lord, ruler, host, king of the universe. So it's safe to assume that this is a male deity. And if he's the only one, what the first commandment states is that there was no woman involved in the creation of the universe. Up until the time that this sentence was written, there were no people anywhere in the world that ever had a cosmology based on the idea that a man alone could create the world. It was usually a woman alone, two women together, man and a woman together. So if I were to lay the Ten Commandments on a table here and ask everybody in the audience to mentally put them in the sequence of their relative importance for their life today, everybody would put, I'd no doubt, number two, don't murder. But that's not number two. The second most important rule of righteous living is make no images. And it isn't just graven images. The commandment states, and thou shalt create no images of anything that flies in the air, creepeth in the ground, or is under the sea. In other words, no art. So if you step back for a moment and you look at this, you say, was there ever a culture in the entire history of the world that ever banned art? I mean, why would art be more dangerous than murder? Well, isn't it an extraordinary coincidence that the first culture that adopts an alphabetic sacred text is the first culture to ban art? And then you have the Greeks, who are the second culture in the world to enthusiastically embrace the alphabet and realize what an incredible tool this is. And the reason that alphabets are so dramatic is they're so easy to learn. I mean, compared to cuneiform in Mesopotamia or hieroglyphics in Egypt, less than 2% of those populations could read and write. And, you know, there's an old saying that in the valley of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I mean, if you know how to read and write, nobody else does, then you get all the power. Right. So alphabets are so simple a four-year-old can learn. I mean, Forrest Gump can learn the alphabet. So once you have this ability to communicate that's so easy to learn, then you have this extraordinary shift in culture. And what happened is we traded an ear for an eye. You know, once you start to learn to read and write, you shift to vision what had previously been primarily your ear and your tongue. And that produces changes within the brain. I mean, we know that a child is born with an enormous number of neurons. And by the age of 12, there's a tremendous pruning that goes on in your brain where you lose most of the neurons you were born with. And the ones that stay are the ones that were reinforced. So what is the effect on a culture of aiming a machine gun at a five-year-old's eye and start firing in a steady stream of letters and numbers for the next 16, 17 years? What's going to happen is you're going to reinforce the linear sequential mode of perception that is primarily left hemispheric. And that will produce a culture that will denigrate the feminine and will elevate patriarchy and misogyny. Now, it's interesting that, you know, when I wrote the book, I, would get these arguments from people, say, oh, well, it was the invention of private property or the archaic state or the invention of the plow. There's a whole bunch of different reasons, horsemen coming down from the north, that was the real reason why this shift occurred. But a very interesting phenomenon happened in Western culture that none of these other theories can explain. And that is that with the fall of Rome, the most astonishing thing happened. The people in Western Europe lost literacy. I mean, literacy mm-hmm. rates fell to less than 1%. The only books that remained were all locked up in monasteries. Nobody ever saw a book in their whole life, you know, an average person. So this was a time of terrible superstition and barbarity, and strife was the order of the day. Travel dried up to a trickle, and you know, there was no commerce. So most people would predict that women's rights would have suffocated during this period of time. So when the stage of history gets re-illuminated in the 9th century, all over Europe we find troubadours singing the praises of womanhood. Courtly love is all the rage. I mean, the chivalric code. I mean, can you imagine the U.S. Marine Corps manual stating that the highest aspiration is to protect women? That's what the chivalric code stated. Women Christian mystics were hailed by the church. Abbesses led monasteries all over Europe. And the people of Europe began to build these enormous cathedrals that were not dedicated to Jesus, and they weren't dedicated to the Father God. They were dedicated to Notre Dame. So the question comes, where did Mary come from? I mean, Mary is mentioned only 7 times in the Gospels. She's a peripheral figure in the story. And yet during the Middle Ages and the medieval period, my God, she becomes the central figure of Christianity. I mean, there is not a crossroads, a church nave, a shop wall that doesn't have an image of Mary. And interestingly, she doesn't say anything. There's no gospels according, no written gospels according to Mary. I mean, it's all about her image. And I think that Mary is the reemergence of the earth goddess during a time of low literacy rates. And as proof, I submit that you can travel in a wide arc through Europe, through Switzerland, Poland, France, Spain, Italy. You'll find a church somewhere that venerates a statue of a black Madonna. Now, all the people of Europe were Caucasian. So they were substantially blonde and blue-eyed. So why would these people be venerating a black Madonna? And the answer to that question, I think, is that all of the manifestations of the earth goddess were black. I mean, soil is black and night is black. And Kali, Artemis, Cybele, Athena, all of these goddesses were, if you look at the manifestation, they're black. And the phenomenon of the black Madonna disappears or begins to wane in the high Middle Ages, and then the Renaissance begins. And the Renaissance was fueled by the most astonishing invention that Life magazine called the greatest invention of the last 1,000 years, Gutenberg's printing press. So you have literacy rates in the high teens suddenly skyrocket, and people rush to learn this, read this book that they've heard so much about. And the book is the New Testament, and the New Testament is indisputably about love and kindness and forgiveness. So it should therefore follow, shouldn't it, that people reading this book for the first time should begin to behave toward their neighbors in a very loving, kind, and forgiving fashion. But that's not what happened at all. What happened was the Protestant Reformation, led by a very harsh group of patriarchal men, who said, in essence, to the church, we can read this book by ourselves now. We want to change the religion. And high on our list of reforms is we want to get rid of Mary. We want to destroy all the images. And by the way, when the new Christian church became the state religion in Rome in 313, after they had a New Testament, the first thing they did was to destroy all the images and get rid of the goddess temples. Mm-hmm. So the Protestants get rid of Mary, and they whitewash all the churches. And then these religious wars break out. And the Huguenots and the Catholics in France start killing each other, and the Puritans and the Presbyterians and the Anglicans in England start killing each other, and the Calvinists and the Luthers in Germany start killing each other, and the Catholics start killing the Jews and Moors in Spain. And if you're looking for this period of history in the history books, you find it under the heading, the Age of Reason. that this is the period of Western culture that is making the most extraordinary gains in science and mathematics and music and architecture and global exploration. And yet, this is the period when they went demonstrably mad. They were just the most unbelievable religious wars. But if you needed further evidence, the best that I could present is the fact that the males of the species, of this culture, suffered a psychosis so extreme that they thought their women were so dangerous they needed to murder them. And murder them they did. The witch hunts did not occur in the Dark Ages. They did not occur in the medieval period or the Middle Ages. They occurred smack in the middle of the Renaissance. The countries that experienced the steepest rise in literacy rates, Germany, Switzerland, France, England, they had terrible witch hunts. Russia, which remained illiterate throughout this whole period, they didn't have any witch hunts. Bosnia and Hungary, which were under Muslim rule, and the Muslims didn't adopt the printing press to the 19th century, they didn't have any witch hunts. If you went to a Hopi Indian or a Navajo or a Inuit or a Polynesian and you said, excuse me, would you believe that there's a culture in the world where the men are murdering their wives' women? They'd look at you in disbelief. They'd say that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. That everybody knows that the men are supposed to go into the next village and kill those men and steal the women, but you would never kill your own women. There has never been an adequate explanation for why sophisticated Europe, the only culture in the world at that time that dined with a knife and a fork, would have killed their own women. It's just a strange, strange episode. And I believe that everything changed in the 19th century when we discovered electromagnetism and invented photography. Because photography did for images and the right brain what the printing press and text had done for the left brain. It elevated it. So by the end of the 19th century, there was hardly anybody who had not sat for their photograph. I mean, electromagnetism and film photographs come together to produce film. And I just read in the paper this morning that this new movie, Spider-Man, you know, is going to gross, I don't know, over $100 million in the first weekend that's out. And, you know, within 8 years of the introduction of film, film attendance surpassed church attendance. And it's never been close since. So, you know, the personal computer comes along. First then comes television. And television changed everything. I mean, television requires a different hemispheric strategy to see television. If you put EEG leads on somebody's brain and you ask them to read a book and you give them, you pick a book at random off the shelf, it doesn't matter what the content is. The person generates something called beta waves. And beta waves are what you generate when you're concentrating. And we all know that to read a book, you have to concentrate. If you're in a real noisy room, you'll get up and you'll find someplace quiet to read. If you ask the person to look up from their book and start watching a television program, it doesn't matter what the program is. It could be about sex and violence, the news, nature program, the cuddly koala bears. It doesn't matter. The beta waves go away, and alpha and theta waves come up. And alpha and theta is what you generate when you meditate. I mean, does anybody in your audience not have the experience of coming home from a hard day's work and taking that clicker and
zoning out,
going into a trance television? Right. In fact, the word most commonly used by people when asked what's the experience of watching television like, they say it's hypnotizing. So if you look at it another way by using a PET scan, which measures the brain activity, and you give somebody a book to read, it's primarily their left hemisphere that's lit up, and the right hemisphere is dark. And if you ask them to look up at a television program, you could choose any program at random, and the left hemisphere goes dark, and the right hemisphere lights up. Now, in a world that has one television set for every two people on the planet, how could that not make a profound difference? So Western culture has been moved primarily by long, imageless tomes written by esteemed white males. I mean, Plato, Augustine, Aquinas, Marx, Hegel, Freud. These are the books that changed the whole movement of Western culture. Has there been a single book written by anybody in the last 50 years since the introduction of television that begins to compare to the power of the image, the image of the atomic bomb blast in 45, or the image of the Earth beamed back from space in 68, did more to change people's consciousness and attitudes than any book that's been written? Can anyone doubt that the images of 9/11 are seared into everybody's brain around the world? They carry more emotional freight than any book or article or editorial that's been written about that event. So we now live in this world where we have this visual archive of images of the most dramatic events of our lives. If I say to you, little girl running down the street naked, I don't even have to finish. Right, and you know, right. I'm talking about the Vietnam War. So these images are very powerful. And then along comes the personal computer and the internet. And once again, we have this new medium of communication that's completely changing the world. And I maintain it's feminizing the world.
Yeah, so.
Well, for 5,000 years, the only way you could write was to write with one hand. You could put your left hand in your pocket when you're writing because you don't even need it. Then along comes the typewriter keyboard. And Remington invents the typewriter in the 1880s or 90s. And the problem is only women learn how to type. You have to type with both hands. And then the personal computer gets invented in the 70s, and all the men rush to learn a skill that their grandfathers considered was for sissies, called typing. Hmm. Mm-hmm. So what's the effect on the world of having millions of men's left hands connected to millions of men's right brains that have to tap out one half of every written message? And furthermore, when you're writing, and you know, you have to watch what you're writing. If you looked away when you were writing, your writing would go all over the place.
Yeah.
So, you know, the manufacturer gives you lined paper, so you'll stay very linear. The next time someone operates a computer, you watch them. They're looking at the screen, and they're doing this mm-hmm. with their right hand with the mouse. Well, the left brain doesn't know how to do this. This is a visual spatial skill. So I maintain that the function of a computer is feminine. I mean, it's all about hypertext and simultaneous a perception of, you can go deep into windows. I mean, they're called windows. You click on icons. I mean, it's not, mm-hmm. it's all about images. Now, what is the effect of an 8-year-old boy to log on to the World Wide Web or the internet? The last time I looked, every ancient deity associated with webs and nets was a goddess. So as a result, I think that this is a influence along with TV and movies and photography that our world is now flooded with image information, for which we need to use our right hemispheres. So Western culture is becoming decidedly more feminine. I mean, women are become priestesses again, their own property. A woman commander led the last space shot. I mean, 40% of the Washington State legislature are women. The Massachusetts Supreme Court majority are women. That would be unthinkable 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And men are leading the ecology movement, which is to honor and protect the world and nature rather than conquer and subdue it. So I think that we're witnessing this extraordinary shift, as dramatic as what happened when our species first learned how to read and write,
mm-hmm.
that this image-based technological information age that we live in is shifting the world back to a feminine focus. And women are regaining the power that they once had.
That's a fascinating and overarching theory. And as you mention in your book, each of the periods that we look at seem to be tessera in an overall mosaic that becomes very convincing when you
right.
read the alphabet versus the goddess.
It's a real hard theory to explain to somebody at a cocktail party
oh, yeah, right.
in a few minutes, I'll tell you that. But I mean, in the book, I can obviously lay out a
yeah.
lot more nuanced argument than I can in
right.
a brief interview like this or in a presentation like I'm going to do tomorrow night.
Well, I was wondering if you could elaborate. In your book, you point out how when the person is looking, say, out from Founders Hall at those magnificent sunsets,
right.
you take in all of the coloration of the
right.
clouds and the ocean, and you use the word contemplate.
Right.
And yet, if I all of a sudden try to see that mystical green light just as the sun drips over
right.
the horizon, I kick into concentration, and
right.
I can feel the musculature of my
right.
face squinting.
Right.
Last summer, I took a picture of a calligrapher mm-hmm. composing script, and that was exactly that kind of concentration that I guess you describe it, the left hemispheric intensity,
right.
the beta waves emitting. Could you elaborate on how the cones and the rods distribute, how, in fact, we are men and women
right.
are hardwired differently?
Yeah, in the book I talk about three different modalities. The first thing is the split brain.
Yeah.
The other one is our preferenced hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're the animal that's handed. And the third thing is we have two different visual fields in our eyes. I mean, your retina is divided into rods and cones. And the rods fill up your retina. They're little cells that detect the slightest amount of light. So with your rods, you see the slightest movement out in the periphery. You see in the dark. And you get the big picture with your rods. You contemplate with your rods. When you look at something contemplative, your eyes unfocus. And you kind of, you're looking at nothing, but you see everything. I mean, you take in
right.
the whole picture.
Uh-huh.
Cone vision occupies less than 1% of your retina. And cone vision gives to your eye incredible clarity, acuity, and color vision. But the problem is it's like looking down a cardboard tube with your cones. You can only see one detail. And then if you want to look at something else, you have to move your eyes. So you see one thing after another with your rods, with your cones, rather. And, you know, when you're concentrating on something, you know, you furrow your brow. And what that does is that
yeah.
cuts down the amount of light that comes into your eyes. And your pupil gets small and narrow so that cone vision is activated and you cut down on the rod vision. But when you are relaxed and open-eyed and your eyes are open and your pupils are dilated, your rods are activated. Well, it turns out that women have more rods in their eyes than men do. And men have more cones in their eyes than women do. And the numerous studies have shown that women can perform multiple simultaneous tasks
mm-hmm.
and do them all well, better than men. And men can focus on one task and zero in on it and not let anything else distract them better than women. And if you think about it, the kind of vision that the cones see is a very masculine way of looking at the world, as opposed to the kind of gestalt vision that women have. You know, if a man and a woman walk in a room and then they leave after 10 minutes and you ask the man, what name the objects that were in the room, he can name many less objects than a woman can. And there's not a man alive who hasn't come out
yeah.
of a party with his wife, and the wife said, did you notice this, and notice that, and notice this? And the guy said, gee, where was I? Were we at the same party? I mean, you know. So I think that men acknowledge that there's a very big difference between the way they see and the way women see. And then there's this extraordinary change in the corpus callosum. You know, the most dichotomous brain belongs to a right-handed heterosexual male. And by dichotomous, I mean that the hemispheric functions are so split that in this one subset, this heterosexual right-handed male has 97% of his language centers located in his left hemisphere. And then his corpus callosum is 15 to 30% smaller than women, left-handed men and women, and gay men and women. Now, the significance of that is that if a right-handed heterosexual male has a stroke in his left hemisphere, it's a catastrophe. because he loses the ability to communicate, and it's very unlikely he's going to recover very much of it. If a woman was to have the same size stroke in that hemisphere, she would, because she's got language centers on the other side, she'll recover much faster. Now, women, when they learned this, thought, oh, well, you know, these men are emotionally impoverished because not only can they not access their emotions that are on the right hemisphere, but because they have a smaller corpus callosum, but they're much less balanced. And that is true, but the advantage from an evolutionary point of view is that if you're a man stalking an incredibly dangerous animal that can turn around and kill you at any given moment, and you're focusing on the intent of what you're trying to do, the last thing you want is a bunch of extraneous information and emotions leaking over from the other side. And you need to have one whole hemisphere.
No distraction.
Devoted to visual, right. Spatial skills. Accurate throwing, accurate aiming, being able to find your way home when you're deep out in the forest. So men's visual spatial skills are better than women's, because they had to go further away from a base and accurately throw something at an animal to kill it. So there are evolutionary reasons why all these differences exist.
There is a visible difference in the populations of the different cultures that have, say, a logographic script like the Chinese and the alphabetic script of the West. And I thought it was remarkable in your book, you're pointing out the difference in the representation of the Buddha in China and in India.
Well, you know, I maintain that any culture that learns how to read and write, whether it's hieroglyphic, ideographic, or alphabetic, I mean, if preliterate cultures are over here and alphabetic cultures are over here, then ideographic cultures are still over here. It pushes a culture towards patriarchy. And I just wanted to make sure that I don't believe I'm aware of any culture in the world that's a matriarchal culture where women have more power than men. I think that throughout the world, the most egalitarian societies are preliterate agricultural oral societies. It's fascinating to me that China, for example, is a 5,000-year culture. It's one of the oldest cultures in the world. And in this culture, early on, they had a philosophical system, I won't call it a religion, called Taoism, that was very feminine. It extolled the benefits and the virtues of passivity over taking an active role in life. And then they developed another system called Confucianism, where the Confucianism system was based on the principle that a man should control his emotions first, his wife second, and his children third. And that this hierarchical structure was the hierarchical structure that you built the larger society. It was very male-oriented. So it fascinates me that Taoism lost out to Confucianism. And the reason it happened about the same time that the Chinese invented the printing press. And they had the same rise in literacy rates in China that they had in Europe. Not quite as many, because alphabets were designed for a printing press, whereas an ideographic language, the poor printer has to have like 40,000 blocks to one for every character. So if I were to ask your audience, what was the most misogynist thing that the Chinese did to their women in this 5,000-year period? They undoubtedly would answer foot binding. And if I were to then ask them, when in this 5,000-year period was the first recorded case of foot binding, it would be in the first generation after the invention of the Chinese printing press. Now, the Chinese printing press operates by putting a piece of paper in the press and crushing the paper until the ink is transferred to it. And what was happening to the women's feet is the women's feet were being crushed. And the agents that were used to crush her feet were strips of white linen, which is what the Chinese used to invent the paper for their printing presses.
That's right,
Now, I find this an extraordinary coincidence that women should be subjected to this very demeaning and infantilizing type of thing where they can't even stand on their own 2 feet. You know, we say in our culture, you know, a man can stand on his own 2 feet. Well, if you take away the right of someone to stand on their own 2 feet, you're keeping them like a child. You're taking away their power. So what happened is the women that this whole concept of foot binding occurs about that time. And that something that metaphorically was used to promote literacy, which is the printing press, should somehow or other leak over and be to the detriment of women and women's rights. Now, the other interesting thing about what you talked about is the Buddha, and that is that there were three major literate cultures